Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Debate around Israel criticism and where that crosses the line into anti-Semitism has, of course, become increasingly visible, especially online, where we have a number of high-profile commentators reaching millions of people instantly. Figures like Candace Owen, Tucker Carlson, our very own Reddy Klabi generate very strong reactions. But the key question is, number one, how much influence they really have, and what impact this rhetoric has on social discourse. The further question is, how do we deal with it? How do we respond to it without amplifying it further? That's always a question I have when I look at some of the commentators. If I look at Reddy Klabi, for example, and I see that she's had relatively low views on an anti-Semitic or anti-Israel post, do I engage it? Do I respond to it? And in doing so, I obviously risk amplifying it further. Joining us now is a political commentator, Shabbos Kestenbaum. A very, very good morning or good evening to you. Great to have you with us. Starting with the basics, when we talk about figures like this, like the Candace Owens, like the Tucker Carlson, how significant is their influence in shaping public opinion?
Sure. Well, good evening from Los Angeles. Just finished a Thursday night mishmar, special Torah learning before Shabbat. So I always know on Thursday nights after you finish learning, you got to call into African radio. So always a pleasure to connect.
Awesome.
Look, when you put together Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson, they have more weekly listeners than there are Jews on planet Earth. So the idea that we can avoid them, I don't think is true. I think this is where young people especially are receiving their political information. They're quite influential, especially within Gen Z American political discourse. At the same time, though, we do risk, especially in the Jewish community, I would say, amplifying them to the point whereby anything they say is a five-alarm fire. And within the American legal framework, we don't really have a concept of hate speech. So people can, in fact, shout things that are anti-Semitic, that are homophobic, that are bigoted, that are racist. I don't encourage people to do that because I don't think they'll get far ahead in life professionally. But from a legal basis, you can absolutely do that. And the more we simply state that protected hate speech is this five-alarm fire, I don't think that does us a tremendous service. I think that sort of propagates this stereotype anyway, that we as American Jews are trying to curtail other people's free speech. As Charlie Kirk always taught me, the best way to combat bad ideas is with better ideas. So Candace Owens, who I actually just posted about on my Instagram, I don't really focus on her anti-Semitism. I focus on the profundity of her stupidity. I focus just on her terrible, terrible ideas, how backwards and wrong they are. I focus on the fact that she's a pathological liar, and anti-Semitism is merely a manifestation of her innate stupidity, and I think that's a far more effective argument.
In fact, maybe I'm guilty of that. We've got she was a South African personality radio host, went to live in the U.S. and works for Al Jazeera. Her name is Reddy Klabi. She has close to maybe 800,000, somewhere around there, followers, but a very, very important voice still here in South Africa, and is absolutely rabidly anti-Israel, anti-Jewish, although she claims to love Jews, of course, but real Jews aren't Zionists. That's the other thing. And it's always a question, how much do we engage and therefore amplify? And I think I'm guilty of engaging on the anti-Semitism side, but maybe it needs to shift and actually talk to where she lacks credibility as far as being a journalist is concerned.
Right. Well, I'll put it this way. Again, I'll use the American legal framework as my point of reference here. When students or professors yell on Harvard's campus, for example, from the river to the sea, we have done ourselves a tremendous disservice by framing the conversation as to whether that is or isn't anti-Semitic. And that misses the point, because let's assume for argument's sake it's not anti-Semitic. I mean, even though, again, Hamas calls for that in their charter, they're calling for the eradication of the Jew from the river to the sea, they're not interested in a democracy or two states or multiculturalism, they're interested in killing of the infidel by the sword, but let's assume it's not anti-Semitic. From a political perspective, it is a terrible idea. What, you want to get rid of the only democracy in the Middle East? Where exactly are 7 million Jews meant to go? So whether it is or isn't anti-Semitic misses the much larger point, which is this is just, to sound quite rudimentary, a stupid, stupid policy position to be propagating. This does not in any way advance peace, certainly not for the Palestinians, nor for the Jews either. So when we focus more on the pragmatic policy prescriptions rather than whether something is or isn't anti-Semitic, again, I just think it's a far more effective argument and you will be able to sway people. In fact, there's an organization called Stop Anti-Semitism. It's an American NGO and they do very good things. I know the founder, she's a good person. But one of my criticisms for the, in fact, it's really my only criticism of the organization, is they have an annual Anti-Semite of the Year. And it's almost become a joke amongst the far right and the far left within political discourse as to who gets to win it. And they try to outbid each other. You know, well, I already denied the Holocaust. What more can I do to win the number one spot of anti-Semite of the year? And if we stopped focusing on people's anti-Semitism and instead started focusing on, you know, their moral bankruptcy and their political hypocrisy, again, I think we would be able to sway a lot more hearts and minds as opposed to constantly using the term anti-Semitism, which I hate to say it because I wish it wasn't true, but it means almost nothing within our temporary political discourse. It has lost so much of its meaning. And I think part of it is because the American Jewish establishment has used it as a pretext for things that aren't legally permissible.
It's so interesting because as you're saying that and you're talking about the fact that the word anti-Semitism is meaningless, and I tend to agree with you, it has become that. Much of this war has been about the meaning of words. It's about reducing, as a South African, we know full well what apartheid is and what it isn't, but yet the word has been reduced to mean anything that I don't like happening in Israel. Holocaust, genocide, all of these words, including anti-Semitism, have been reduced to virtual meaninglessness. This is very, very much a fight, a war on words and a war on meaning. We're fighting for truth, and unfortunately, our enemies are fighting for fiction or a fallacy. So, are you saying that the way to approach this is just to completely step around the words and look at the argument and look at the essence, what lies beneath it, because the words in of themselves have actually lost power?
Yes and no. So again, to be clear, anti-Semitism can legally cross the line. I think, sure, I'm a pretty good example of it, given the fact that, you know, I sued my school for anti-Semitism. When there are people who commit anti-Semitic crimes, then absolutely you should prosecute them to the fullest extent of the law. In fact, this is another conversation we can have later about the inefficacy of sending anti-Semites to Holocaust museums. I think what would be far more effective is if we sent them to jail, but I digress. So it can be. When there are crimes being committed that are anti-Semitic in nature, absolutely prosecute. I'm not saying lie down and take it. That's not what I'm suggesting. Mm. What I am suggesting is when it comes to protected speech, when it comes to actions or protests that are within the realms of the First Amendment, to simply shout anti-Semitism, even if you're right, which I probably do think you're right, it's just not going to win people over. And I think the great tragedy of the Jew post October 7th is we are really good at covert pager operations. We're really good at striking an Ayatollah. We're really good at, you know, defanging the IRGC or Hamas or Hezbollah, but we're really not good, to your point, in the battle of ideas, in the information war, in the PR war. I mean, how is it that just last week, every single Democratic senator, with the exception of seven, voted to stop sending military weapons, including defensive weaponry like the Iron Dome, to Israel? I mean, how is that possible? Yeah. That in the face of the greatest act of terrorism against the Jews since the Holocaust, almost the entirety of the Democratic Party will turn on us? And I think part of it, not all of it, but certainly part of it, is because I think Jews just overplayed their hand, American Jews, at least, in the American Jewish establishment. And one of the ways that we can correct it is, as I was saying earlier, focus on the pragmatic policy outcomes of what these people are advocating for. So instead of saying not supplying the Iron Dome to Israel is anti-Semitic, what you should instead say is if you truly want peace in the Middle East, then you would ensure that Israel does not have to wage war. And if they have defensive weaponry like an Iron Dome, then the odds of them going into a Lebanon or Gaza in the future are much lower. So just point, you know, their political stupidity or hypocrisy. I think, again, that's far more effective.
It's interesting that if you consider what happened this week in the United Kingdom, I find it really, really fascinating as well, where you've got this young guy or young guys who were arrested for firebombing a shul, a synagogue. His defense is, I didn't know it was a synagogue, therefore it couldn't have been anti-Semitic. And I think that kind of talks to your point. So now, does the whole thing hinge on whether he's an anti-Semite or not? Surely, surely that's reached a level of absurdity. So in London, you can go around firebombing buildings at night as long as they're not Jewish buildings. Like, how does anything make sense?
Right.
So so in that case, I mean, there's definitely a place for the anti-Semitic part, because we see this increase, horrific increase of anti-Semitic acts in the United Kingdom. It has to be dealt with in of itself. But how do you bring the two, therefore, together when you look at the act versus the intention?
Right. This actually reminds me of what the former Harvard president Larry Summers often would call the two types of anti-Semitism. There's anti-Semitism in intent and anti-Semitism in effect. So an example would be calling for the globalization of the Intifada. You can truly believe that an Intifada is simply Arabic for uprising and it's calling for a multi-ethnic democracy from the river to the sea. You can truly believe that. I mean, you'd be wrong. Hamas doesn't believe that that's what it means, but I digress. So irrelevant of what the intent is, whether you think it's, you know, good or bad, in effect, it absolutely is anti-Semitic, because what you are calling for is the abolishment of the only Jewish democratic state in the world. So when it comes to the United Kingdom, I think the same principle applies. It's just far more tricky because a country like the United Kingdom, A, has, you know, almost non-existent free speech laws, but B, has clearly shown, particularly under the Keir Starmer administration, that they are proud of their unequal enforcement of the laws on the books. So, you know, rightly or wrongly, as I said, the United Kingdom really does not have robust speech laws at all. In fact, they used to have, it's since been disbanded in the last couple of months, but they used to have thousands of individuals being arrested for social media posts. You know, there would be a division of the Met police scanning people's Facebook pages and knocking on their doors to detain them. But the hypocrisy, of course, is while you'd be arrested for speaking out about things like COVID lockdowns, you can also have your weekly hate marches through the streets of London calling for the abolishment of Israel, calling for a mass uprising of an intifada, and that would be acceptable. So it's often what Tommy Robinson calls, you know, this two-tier policing. So it's far tricky, and I know this wasn't the point of your question, but I would just add, on a personal level, you know, my whole family is British. They almost all of them still live there, but almost every Shabbat meal is, when are you leaving? Well, when are you leaving? And I would certainly encourage the Jewish community of the United Kingdom to recognize, stop staying in places where you're not wanted. But I digress.
So just finally coming back to the influences that we started off talking about, the best approach is what? Do we completely ignore them? Do we watch them? Do we respond to them? And I understand what you're saying in terms of how we respond. And I think that certainly resonates for me. What do we say to people who have no intention of responding to them? Because most people don't. They just see it, get upset by it and move on. What do you think should be the approach here?
Well, to quote another former president of Harvard, the infamous Claudine Gay, it kind of depends on the context.
Oh, gosh.
So Candace Owens happens.
There's a quote I didn't see coming at this during this interview.
Exactly. So Candace Owens happens to be a good case study simply because in the last few days, including tonight, I posted several times about Candace Owens. One of them was actually over the fact that my lawyer, Mark Kasowitz of Kasowitz Benson Torres, who we hired when we sued Harvard University, is the same same lawyer that Candace Owens just hired to represent her against her defamation case against the First Lady of France, Brigitte Macron. So I pointed out, and as did Laura Loomer, and this generated millions of views and impressions, that Candace, even someone like Candace Owens knows that if you truly want the job done right, you need a unabashedly pro-Israel Zionist like Mark Kasowitz. So in that sense, if we can point out, again, the moral bankruptcy and the intellectual hypocrisy, it will do us a tremendous service. But I would also caution your listeners, and again, the Jewish community at large, getting into social media battles with accounts that are most probably bots. No, I don't think that's a good use of one's time. But I would say the larger accounts, those accounts that, as I said, have more weekly listeners than there are Jews on planet Earth, if we can point out the holes in their arguments, if we can point out that these are just, I'm sorry to say, low IQ, intellectually challenged grifters who are making money by peddling lies and feeding off of the stupidity of their listeners, then yeah, why wouldn't we make those arguments? But stop simply resorting to the easiest tactic, which is just the A word, anti-Semitism.
Absolutely right. That's where we leave it. Shabbos Kestenbaum, thank you as always. Wishing you a Shabbat Shalom.